My name is Bill Grace. For those of you who don't know me, as someone said this morning, if you were at Esther's Bible study, even if you do know me, my name is still Bill Grace. And today we're going to be talking about racism. And if you were here at yesterday's session, what we said is that slanted or tainted justice, meaning justice that we have Americanized or Westernized, different than a biblical understanding of justice, yields forms of communities, forms of structures in which goods are not often distributed in ways that provides equal access. We're going to take a look at this one today, and we're going to be looking at sexism on Saturday. Today, what I'd like to do, in order to get us started, I've said in my last two sessions that I would like to have more small group discussion and never got there, so I'm going to start out by doing some stuff with you folks talking to each other. One of the things I believe is that when we look at concepts like racism and sexism, they're very volatile. They conjure in us great emotions that cause us either to kind of clam up because our experiences are too personal, or they cause us to get defensive, and we feel like we need to begin to defend what is as opposed to what should be. So I'd like to start out from a point of common ground, if we can. And again, knowing that we're going to be talking about the isms, and that's what this final one is. I mean, there's all kinds of isms. I was just talking to somebody at coffee break. This person's from the South, and she moved to the northern middle states and encountered what she called regionalism. That the view of the people from the South is that they were slower and dumber and not quite as bright as the people from the Northeast. So we have all kinds of isms, but racism and sexism, I think, are the most powerful, and I would rank among those sexual preferencism, because they take whole groups of people and separate them out and treat them differently. But back to the notion of common ground, I'd like to start by asking you to turn to a neighbor, turn to one other person, or if you would like to talk to two other people, that'd be great, and do this. Think of a time when someone took advantage of you. Think of a time when someone took advantage of you. Tell that story, let the other person tell you her or his story, and then do this, a third step. Think about what's common in your stories. And what I want to do when we report back in just about 3 minutes, I want to list some of the commonalities on the board. So find someone to talk to. Talk to that person about a time where someone took advantage of you. And then listen to both stories, the one you're telling as well, and listen for what's common in those stories. And then we'll talk about those commonalities in just a few minutes. Go ahead and tell those stories.
Yeah, I'm just going to add the word stupid to that.
Okay. I'm looking for a word, and it's kind of here, but it's not been expressed specifically.
Hurt.
Hurt. Let's put that down, too.
Betrayed.
What was that one?
Weak. Betrayed.
Weak, betrayed. These are all good ones. How about the notion of powerlessness? Mm-hmm. Did that come up? Am I adding that word, or does that make sense to your stories?
I think that sounds better than what I meant to say, other than helpless.
Okay.
I like that word.
Grateful.
Grateful. Explain that one, Bob.
Well, as we discussed it, I've told about the time that I worked for a fruit candy for 104 and a half hours in 1 week and earned almost $35. And when I came off shift, there were upwards of 1,000 people hoping to take the next shift. I was grateful to get the less than $35, even though the company, you can say, was taking advantage of me. On the other hand, a few years later, they had to close the plant because it was unprofitable, even at 32 and a half cents an hour.
Okay.
So they really didn't have any choice either.
So you're looking at it as a kind of compared to some other types of oppression. You were oppressed less and
I was powerless, but so were they.
Okay.
I've been grateful just because it's a growing experience, I guess.
Okay, so we look back on it and we say, well, you know, I survived it and I've learned from it.
Self-righteous.
Okay, so self-righteous. Who said that? After when being taken advantage of?
Yeah, I got a lot of, I think it came out of the anger. or the other person, I'm better than them.
Okay, okay.
That kind of stuff.
Self-righteous. All right, let's try something a little bit different here. Think of a time when you took advantage of someone. No, that doesn't do it. One of the things, I love watching the group's eyes. You know, I asked the first question, you know, think of a time when someone took advantage of it, and people are going, yeah, I remember that. You know, pops right to me. Think of a time when you took advantage of something. You know, and I always say to groups, you know, if you're having difficulty, think of your children, think of your parents, you know. Think of a time when you took advantage of someone. Find the same person or a different person if you'd like to meet someone different. And tell that story, and then list what's common in those stories. Okay?
Most of the time.
Yeah. Manipulation. Okay.
Sam. And desperate.
All right, let me stop there, and I want to ask something. Recall your story when you were taken advantage of, just for a moment. I saw the lights go on immediately. When someone was taken advantage of you, how many of you knew it right away? Hey, wait a minute, something's wrong here. I'm being taken advantage of. A lot of heads. Yeah, we typically know when we're being taken. Sometimes if somebody's real tricky, we don't know after the fact. But typically we get in touch with that. How many people were surprised by someone saying to you at some point in your life, hey, you're really taking advantage of me, and you kind of had to go, oh, you know, I didn't know I was taking advantage of you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
This is what happens. If we call these our down categories, each of us have had categories where we've been a down, where someone has taken advantage of us. We also have our up categories. It's typically when we're taking advantage of someone else. Now the interesting thing is that people who are in their down categories usually know what's going on. They usually know what's going on. And I call them smart downs. If you want to know what's going on, ask a down. Most ups, typically, depending on what system we're talking about, don't know oftentimes that they're taking advantage of someone else. And I call them dumb ups.
Or don't care to know.
They don't care to know. It brings on too much guilt. Now, here's the trick, and this is what we're going to be spending the rest of the morning on. We've all had our down categories. We know what it's like to feel helpless and angry and intruded upon. And we know what injustice is like, and to be deceived and disappointed and sad and hurt and weak. We know what that's like. Now, this is what most of us do. We move out of our smart down categories when we know what that's like, and we know what it's like to live like that. We know it's not nice. We move up, we move to an up category. We forget what it was like to be a down, and we go dumb up. What I would like us to challenge ourselves to do is to how to take this smartness, this sensitivity from having been taken advantage, and move it over to our up category so we can start becoming smart ups. Because if you have privilege and power in this country, and if you're white and if you're male, you have a lot of it, the country cannot afford for you to be a dumb up. You need to take a look at how you can become a smart up. And the only way to do that is to remember what it was like to be a down. Is that making sense?
So how can we keep electing these dumb ups? Because they reflect.
They get dumb after we elect them.
Let me illustrate a point. And I'm going to pick on my good friend Carl. Carl, what does it mean to be white in America today?
What does it mean to be white? Well, I guess for me, where I come from, normal.
Okay. What does it mean to be white? More specifically, what does it mean to be white in America today?
Superior, I guess.
Okay. Keep going.
Well, in control. You know, we have white president, white governor where I come from.
Okay.
You know.
The typical response to that question, and I think Carl thinks on his feet pretty well, when I ask that question of mostly white groups, this is the response. What does it mean to be white in America today? I don't know.
Dumb us.
I haven't thought about it, right? Because being white means not having to ask the question. It's normal. What does it mean to be white? It means that you're normal. It means not having to ask the question. It means that being a dumb up is okay. Now, Carl and I happen to be dumb ups. I would say that all of us, white men in the room, are dumb ups, unless we make a commitment every morning when we wake up to try to be a smart up. I said last night during one of the discussions, I have a friend of mine who describes himself as a recovering sexist. Kind of like a recovering alcoholic, I need to make a commitment every day to be different. I'm a recovering sexist. I'm a recovering racist. I'm a recovering sexual preferences. I need to make commitments every day to do something different. Otherwise, my whole culture that I'm surrounded by is dumb up. And it's easy for me to become that unless I consciously choose to do something different. Does this make sense? Okay. Let me give you a little bit of theory about why this is this way, and then we're going to get into some small groups and talk about what can we do about it. Let me ask you this question. I thought about this last night. I actually like to do it, that also you can stretch your limbs. Stand up. Stand up out of your seat. No, let me finish. I'm sorry. I was being dramatic.
Dumb there. Real dumb.
I was being dumb. For the people on the tape, you can sit down. Okay. I was being dramatic. Stand up if you would like racism to be eliminated. Is anyone sitting down? I don't think so. Let me ask you this question. Why, if everyone in this room would like to eliminate racism, why does it persist? Why does it persist among so much individual goodwill? And the answer is institutional racism. And let me describe that to you a little bit. You can have a seat. There's a guy at the University of Minnesota, another person who found God's country. His name is Bob Terry. He's done a lot of work with the concept of institutional racism, and he says that all institutions are made up of four components. This is his diamond model. Said there is mission. Mission is towards which an institution is going, its goals, its purposes, etc. There's power. Power is by which. What gives it energy? There's structure. This is through which. These are policies, procedures, and resources are with which. This is money and actually people sometimes. But these are the four components of any organization. No matter what organization you think of, the church, the company you work with, the school district you belong to, the country. And what I'd like to do is to take a look at America with the use of this model. I'd like you to shout out these answers with resoundingly. When I ask you to think about who controls the mission in this culture, I would like you to shout out a color and a gender. Who controls the mission in America?
White males.
White males. The founding fathers, right? Who controls power in this country?
Money.
Who controls structure? You bet. In this country.
White
males. Resources? White males.
We are told that the women own the majority of the stock in the United States.
But they don't control it. They only own it.
Bob, carry your point further. What are you trying to say about that?
After all, in a capitalist society, and maybe in any other society, money is one of the biggest resources in accomplishing goals. If women own most of the stock, somebody over here says they don't control it, they do control it, even though they may default abrogate that control, they do control their stock.
Let me share two statistics with you that might counter that a little bit. In 1968, the average woman, for every $1 a male made, the average woman earned how much? About 67 cents is right. Then we've had the Equal Rights Amendment. We've had women's rights caucuses. We've had a lot of sensitivity and openness, awareness of this problem. And we have made it to a place 22 years later. So now, in 1990, what do women make?
70 cents.
According to the statistics I have, it's 66 cents. Women have dropped a penny in spite of all of the efforts that we've made. Let me share another statistic with you. I think you all know this. When there's a couple who's married and they have a divorce, what happens to the husband's income? What happens to the women's income? The feminization of poverty, right? You know, Bob, we might need to talk about that a little bit afterwards, but I would differ with you and say that women really do control less resources in this country, as evidenced by some of those statistics. But back to this notion of mission white males, power white males, structure white males, resources white males, you see, that's a club. Let's call it the white male club. And what we need in this culture is a sharing of the mission, a sharing of the power, a sharing of the structure, and a sharing of the resources. The question that white men need to ask themselves is, why is it in your self-interest to do that? Anybody want to venture a guess?
Comfort.
What's that?
Comfort.
Comfort. Why is it in the best interest of white men to do that?
Stops the revolution.
Speaks more about that, Bob.
Well, it's, at some point there will be another club that is formed.
Okay. Do you remember your list of feelings too? That when we took advantage of people, we felt powerful, but we also felt what?
Guilty.
Most white men I know feel guilty. And I think it's because we know we're living in an inauthentic system in which white men have more privileges, have more what I would call unearned advantages than women or people of color. So one of the reasons why it's in my self-interest to do that is because I want to feel less guilty. I also want to stop the revolution and have my children inherit a world that's a little bit more peaceful. Let me pass out a couple things, because I'd like to, based on this model, try to give you some definitions of racism. If I can have some of you folks help pass these out. Raise your hand if you think you're prejudiced. Raise your hand if you think you're prejudiced. Look around. Okay. Human condition, prejudice.
Hey, Oregon, raise your hand.
I raised my hand twice. Particularly about California.
Human condition, one of the human conditions that we have to live with, it's one of our frailties, somehow God made us this way, is we're prejudiced. That's human. That's normal. Take an imbalanced society, take an imbalanced diamond model, and give power to white males, and we get prejudice plus power equals racism. Under this model, blacks and Chicanos cannot be racist. Women cannot be sexist. Because blacks and Chicanos can be prejudiced, but as a whole, as an institution, the Chicano culture, the black culture, the African-American culture in this country doesn't control the system. And so their prejudice doesn't have as much influence. So whites can be prejudiced in this culture, and men can be sexist. And white men, unfortunately, can be and are sexist and racist, unless you do something intentionally different. So with that in mind, let's just take a look at a couple of these definitions on the sheet. Did everybody get one? I hope if not, look on. Okay, middle of the first page, white racism. There you go. Power plus prejudice equals racism. I want to turn your attention to page 3, who is a racist? And then we'll read racist society. Let's start with racist society. Would someone read that, please?
Is one in which social policies, procedures, decisions, habits, and acts do in fact subjugate a race of people and permit another race to maintain control over them. No society will distribute social benefits in a perfectly equitable way, but no society need use race as a criterion to determine who will be rewarded and who punished. Any nation which permits race to affect those who benefit from social policies is racist.
Okay, let's stop there. Can somebody quote from me, and I have a couple if we can't come up with them, some glaring statistics that would demonstrate the fact that we have a racist society? Again, if we're all people of goodwill, what's promoting racism? Are the culture itself. Can you give me a couple examples of how? Yeah.
Blacks make up a much higher percentage of the prison population.
You bet.
Than they do the open population.
One of the statistics you'll look at is that blacks make up 75% of the prison inmates in the South, and whites make up 75% of the prison guards.
Drop-off rates among Native Americans is 3-1 over their population.
It's becoming 4-5-1. Yeah, absolutely. Right here.
That's what it is.
Okay.
Well, we virtually killed off most of the Native American population.
You bet.
Throughout the whole continent.
Genocide, right? We talk openly and criticize the German culture during World War II, as we should, for allowing the atrocity known as the Holocaust to occur. But no one ever refers to the Native American genocide as a Holocaust, and it absolutely was. Power of the definition again, right? Those who control power control the definition. So we didn't commit genocide, we just moved the Indians to the reservation. It's kind of nice, you know? We moved them there. If you have a friend who's going to move and you help them move, that's a nice thing to do. So what do? We move the Indians to the reservation. Another statistic that I find to be just alarming, because I work at colleges and universities, a black youth, black male between the ages of 17 and 24 in this country is more likely to go to jail than they are to go to college. Is there something wrong with the black culture that manifests that? Or is there something wrong with America's culture that manifests that? We used to think that blacks were only what? 3/5 of a person. Matter of fact, we believed that so much we wrote that into our Constitution. We participate in the marginalizing of human beings under this system. So we live in a racist society. Now let's take a little bit more of a personal look. Would someone read just below that, who is a racist?
All white individuals in our society are racists, even if whites are totally free from all conscious racial prejudices, they remain racist, for they receive benefits distributed by a white racist society through its institutions. Our institutional and cultural processes are so arranged as to automatically benefit whites just because they are white. It is essential for whites to recognize that they receive most of these racist benefits automatically, unconsciously, and unintentionally.
Can anyone, this is the hard work of whites. This is the hard work of whites. Can you think of some unearned advantages that you've gained, as it says here, automatically, unconsciously, unintentionally? And if we're struggling with identifying people of color in the room, can help us to see them. Because again, smart downs can see those advantages that sometimes we as dumb ups are oblivious to.
Can basically buy a home any place that we'd like to.
You bet. One of the most compelling ones, when I was first the father of just a Caucasian son, I didn't have to warn him about forms of racism before he went off to school. I didn't have to say, now Nicholas, you know, you're Norwegian, Italian, Irish, and German, and people are going to probably tease you for that. Matter of fact, living in Minnesota, you know, other than the Italian part, he was feeling pretty much at home. My second son is from Korea. He went off to preschool for the first day, and so he came home and sad about the unique shape of his eyes. And for the first time, I thought what it must be like for a family, whether Chicano or African American, what's it like to send your child off to school? I mean, here they are in the protective womb of your home, comforted, nourished, appreciated for who they are. Now you're going to send them off into an institution that by its very nature is racist, school systems. And what's that like? What's that like for the parents? Sending off a child, it was tough enough for me to send off my kids to kindergarten knowing that they'd be pretty well supported. What's it like for a person of color to do that? Most white folk don't need to worry about that. Unearned advantage. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Unfamiliar quotations, it's another thing we do, is we report only portions of our history. I don't know about you, but I was appalled when I read this. Would someone read, not the italicized part, but the piece just below that under unfamiliar quotations?
This was the Pilgrim's leader's warning when he learned that Miles Standish and a half dozen men from the Plymouth colony lured some of the local Indians into their stockade and murdered two chiefs, hung another, and shot or hacked to death three more. No white man had been attacked by any Indian. The alleged reason for the massacre was a plot suspected against the Plymouth settlement. It is a plot whose existence is claimed only by the testimony of those who committed the murders. They called the murders a preventative action, and historians had defined them that way rather than as an early act of individual and savage racism.
One thing that happens to us, if we begin to act towards a particular people in a particular way, we begin to see them that way. Okay? I just want to give you a brief history of slavery. Okay? First, the word slave. The word slave comes from the word Slav, because the first slaves in modern history were from Eastern Europe. Okay? But let's take a look at, and pardon my drawing here, let's say that that's England, and this is kind of Africa, and here's the coast of the United States. About 50 or 60 years before slave trade, the culture in South Africa, especially along the west coast of Africa, was highly prized in a variety of places, but especially in Europe, as being very aesthetically civilized, progressive. As a matter of fact, the arts and the sciences in this part of Africa were in some ways ahead of the time in Eastern Europe. And I may be speaking incorrectly here, but I think I speak correctly that prior to slave trade, the Africans held seats of power and influence in Europe that were significant. And I believe I'm correct in saying that one of the archbishops of Canterbury was black prior to slave trade. Then we get something called the Golden Triangle, which is slaves from Africa are imported to the New World, who take raw materials from the New World back to England. They're produced into producible and saleable goods and brought to Africa. In order for that to happen, in order for human beings to be seen as export, we begin to take a look at the black and the African tradition in a new way. Moving from highly aesthetic scientific, political, powerful people, we now begin to see them as savages. And what's more, our guilt requires us to see them as savages so that we don't feel bad about taking advantage of them. I mean, they're only heathens. Why do you kill Indians? Because they'll kill you. And by the way, who invented scalping?
British.
The French, as I understand it. Maybe the, you know, the French fur trappers, right? That's how they marked their pelts. And so, you know, but again, we typically attribute that to the Native American. So one of the things we do, this is one of the prices that whites pay, by the way, to live in a racist society, we need to pervert our view of the truth. We can't look at things as if the way they really are, because in order to justify racism, we need to see people as less than what they really are, in order to justify our feelings towards them. I'm going to give you one last thing to look at, then we're going to get into small groups, as I promised. And this has to do with the question, after all of this, you know, is Grace just trying to give you a guilt trip for the morning? That's not true. So the profound question that needs to be asked is, so what? And you really only have four choices, and I'm going to narrow that to three pretty quick. Okay? Let's take a look at let's assume for a moment, unless someone would like to take issue with me, that we live in a racist culture. I think we've just proved that. So, what are your choices? Well, your choices is that you can be a racist, or you can be an anti-racist, or you can be active, or you can be passive. Take a look at those combination of choices. Active racist. That's about 3, depending on what part of the country you live in, to 5% of America. Those are bigots, skinheads, white supremacists. And I sense that there's none of you in this room are fit into this category. And if I asked you to raise your hand, you wouldn't anyway, so I won't ask. I'm just going to give you a strategy for dealing with active racists. The best thing to do is to ignore them. Not to ignore the group that they have exposure to, but to ignore them. If there was a bigot in this room who stood up and made a bigoted statement, what I would do literally is to turn my back to that person, and I'd say, I differ with that person. If you'd like to know why, please see me afterwards. I'm not going to engage that person because that just gives that person more airtime. Okay, but that's a strategy for dealing with a bigot. I literally turn my back to the person, and tell the group that I differ because my silence would endorse what that person is saying. So I'm not going to remain silent, but I'm also not going to engage the person. Now, okay, let's look at this one. I think this is intriguing. A passive anti-racist. I'm going to say you don't have that choice because we live in a racist culture. This would be saying that I could sit back and do nothing and things would be just fine. Well, that ain't so. Because in this case, if you're not a part of the solution, you are a part of the problem. So passive anti-racist is not a choice. So here's another choice, passive racist. That is about, from my view of things, is about 75% of the American culture. People who sit by and do nothing and allow a racist culture to do its work, to oppress, to produce all of those statistics that we just mentioned, and we sit by and do nothing. unlike the Good Samaritan. And if my numbers are correct, the other choice is to be an active anti-racist. And that's about 20%. And the good news from my perspective is those numbers are growing. One of my goals in life is to move as many people from this category as possible to that category. And to ignore these people. And to convince people that this ain't possible yet.
What is the definition of an anti-racist?
Someone want to give that a shot? What's the definition of an anti-racist is the question.
I mean, you defined racism earlier as prejudice toward power.
Right. My view of it would be back to this diamond model. If I have access to the mission, power, structure, and resources, I am actively sharing that with people. Okay, one of the things that this model also works this way, mission, power, structure, resources. Okay, I'm going to promise you a 100% increase in wisdom in the next 1 minute. Matter of fact, it's so important, I'll tell you just before I tell it, and I'll tell you just after I tell it so you don't miss it. This is how people usually misperceive the situation. Let's say that there is an organization that you work for that would like more people of color on the in the institution. This is what I see institutions do. They say, well, gee, we would like to have more Chicanos and African Americans in the workforce, but you know, there aren't many in Minneapolis. You know, it's a resource problem. There's no minorities in the Midwest, so how can we get them here? Okay, here comes the 100% increase in wisdom. Whenever you try to solve a problem, if you think it's a resource question, the answer is always one level up. That was it, by the way. Okay. So if you think you have a resource problem, you actually have a structure problem. You don't have a problem with resources. You have a problem with the structure of the way you search for people of color. Matter of fact, what you should do is to take your search process to a place where there are people of color. Take your personnel office to Chicago for a month. And go there and hire people and recruit them to come to Minneapolis. If you're really committed, that's where you'll answer the question. So one of the things you can do to be an active anti is to consider the active ways in which you'll share the mission, share the power, share the structure, share the resources. And if you find yourself making excuses, you're being a passive. If you find yourself creating new opportunities, creating new ways of looking at things, you're being an active. Does that at all help? Speak some more then. We'll get to Bob in a second.
Well, I see that there's more of a root issue below that. I mean, that sounds good, but there are some practical issues that make it tough. I have a small business. I face the same problems that have nothing to do with race. And the problem is institutionalism. I mean, there's a problem when you've got institutions with isms, because it's the issue of the sharing of power. Somebody said power corrupts absolutely. Power corrupts absolutely. The flip side of that is powerlessness oppresses. Absolute powerlessness oppresses absolutely. And so you're always going to have this problem that if you empower the powerless, they're going to become the oppressor.
I mean, not unless they remember what it was like to be a down,
well, that's,
and move into their up categories as smart ups.
Well, that's the trick. That's the trick.
Yeah. Bob?
Will you say something more about the sharing? Because isn't it possible to do some of the sharing as a means of maintaining a position as an active racist?
You bet. You know, how many people heard the Monopoly story? I don't want to tell that again. Let me just tell it real quick.
Where is it?
Matter of fact, these are some of the same people who were playing, right? Not having learned the lesson. Let me tell this, because I think Bob is asking an excellent question. And it has to do with the radical nature of the gospel, I think, the real answer that Bob's getting to. Here's the story. The four of us right here decided we're going to play Monopoly, and I'm going to do this real quick because some people just heard it yesterday, and if you're listening to both tapes, you can turn it off for a second. And because it's the only game in the village, I brought it. They decided to play by not only the Parker Brother rules, but mine as well, which in addition to Parker Brother rules are that I own all the utilities, I own the railroads, and I'm the only one who can buy Boardwalk and Park Place and the Green properties, right? And they've got access to Baltic, Mediterranean, all those little properties. But it's the only game in the village, and they decide to play. Well, it's not very long before I own all the property, and they've mortgaged all theirs. They're going around going every time I'm nailing them, okay? All of a sudden, one of them says, hey, Bill, you know, this game's not fair. You have more access to property than I do. I go, you know, folks, he's right. I'm sorry. From now on, you folks have as much right to property as I do. Let's keep playing. What's going to change? You see, what Bob is talking about, I think, is just an excellent point. We need to look at the nature of institutions and... You see, that Monopoly game, what we call that today is affirmative action, equal access to a rigged game. You know, kind of, let's keep playing the game, but the game is rigged. And there are four prototypes of organizations we need to look at. One is what I would call the white supremacist organization. That's the bold one that says, you know, people of color need not apply. Those don't exist as much publicly. Then we have what I call token sacrificial. This was real popular in the 60s. We bring people of color into the organization. We give them really demanding jobs. We ask them not only to do their job, but to speak on behalf of all people of color who they represent. And we also ask them to be on every committee in the company because we want to have a person of color in the committee. So we bring in a token, we work them to death and sacrifice them. Token sacrificial. The next one is the affirmative action organization. You see, that's where we are now as a country. Equal access to a rigged game. You know, if you want to, hey, you know, Henry Ford started a car company, go ahead. This is America. You have the same opportunities Henry did. Just go start a car company. Affirmative action. Where we need to move towards, there's one way out here that is called the authentic organization, meaning that all mission, power, structure, and resources are shared perfectly equally. I think it's what God has in mind, and I think it's what humans will constantly fall short of. But it's one that it's in between that I'd like us to move us to, and it's what I call the socially responsible organization, where I don't need goals and criteria. I don't need percentages to keep me going. I recognize that the organization is better because we've included the voices of people of color. We've included their experience, which has been oppressed for years. I'm feeling less guilty. We have a more open organization. And somehow, the magic of the gospel is that I'm gifted through giving. I'm gifted by sharing. I'm rich in the amount of things based on how much I can give away. That the richness comes in human relationships, not in how much personal wealth I can claim for myself. Let me read you a quote, and then we'll get into small groups. Bob, did that get at some of what you... Okay. Bob Terry was doing some work with a city back in the Midwest that wanted to better understand how they could be active anti-racists. And he gave them an intriguing task. He said, if you'd like to learn how not to be racist, first thing I'd like you to do is to try to be as racist as you can. So he asked them to design an intentionally racist community. Here's some of their reactions. After some initial bewilderment over the task, the group set about doing the assignment. They surprised themselves on two counts. One, the task of creating now an intentionally racist community. One, the task was easier than they had first imagined it would be. And secondly, without intentionally planning it, the final product clearly resembled their own white community. Here's what they did. Whites kept the power privileges.
Whites secured community benefits. Whites maintained ethnocentrism, which means that white is normal and everything else is different and less than. Not different and equal, which is pluralism, which is wonderful, but whites are different and better than. And whites continued to believe that blacks were the problem race. They gave institutions in this town different responsibilities to maintain this design that they had created. And this breaks my heart. And this is what they said the church should do. What role should the church play? Conclusion. They should not publicly denounce blacks, except if they challenge the white church structure directly like the Black Manifesto. They should maintain a public posture of non-racism. Some of my best friends are black. I don't, you know, I've known you so long, I don't even see you as a person of color. And color indifference. However, get this, in no way should the church members aggressively organize to change the church itself or challenge the implicit assumptions that whites should control decisions, access, and standards. As a matter of fact, it would be good to have an occasional instruction on race as long as nothing substantively changed. How often do we do that in our churches? The evils of racism. No, folks, we're going to have 6 adult forums dedicated to that topic. And who's running coffee hour next week? You know, let's not change anything, but let's talk about it, because it sure is good for the soul. How do you become an active anti? Becoming an active anti is good for our souls and good for our cultures. We're almost, I did it again. We're almost out of time. Yeah.
If you were giving this talk in a different country, Mexico or Japan, I mean, would it be structured the same, but used not something that is white?
That's a good question. I know if I were giving this talk in Central America, I'd be talking about classism, not racism. I'd be talking about a class of people who, by virtue of their wealth, control power. And
There is racism. So.
Okay.
You don't see many blacks or
okay.
Actual indigenous people in power anywhere in Latin okay. America. And there are many Indian and black people throughout Latin America.
I guess I would answer your question by saying this is not somehow a problem only whites have, but it is whites' problem. If you understand that distinction. I guess, you know, what I really wanted to leave you with was a challenge and to somehow support each other in small groups to say, you know, when you go back to your home church, I really would like you to believe when you go back, not because I like laying guilt, but because I believe there's no other way to change the system. I'd like you to firmly believe that if you go back and do nothing, that you're adding to the problem. You will be a passive racist. And going back and doing something, maybe it means for you just reading a book. Maybe it means having a discussion group at your church. Maybe it means something different. But to at least go back and attempt something from the active anti box is what I would like to challenge everybody to do. Even if you've been active anti for a long time, to go back recommitted to do that for others. See if there's anything I forgot. Just like you to read one more compelling statistic. Then I have some more handouts and fact sheets if you'd like those. I'm going to be sending around a participant discussion stimulator, it's called, and we didn't quite get to it, but I'd like you to read this statistic. Because I believe statistics like this are signs of injustice that inspire us to do something different. Listen to this. I'm going to even write this down. Since 1930, over half of the convicted rapists in this country have been white. Half of the convicted rapists in this country have been white. 455 of those convicted rapists have been executed. Of those 455 rapists executed, what, how many do you think are black? 405 of the 455 executed rapists in this country are black. I have more statistics on this stuff if you'd like some. What I guess I'm trying to point out graphically in a kind of hurtful way, and I don't mean to just be a relayer of pain here, but this is painful stuff. It literally kills people. Literally kills people. And our challenge is, and the gospel demands us to do this, I think, is to say, what will we do to intervene? This is a cycle that has not stopped and apparently won't unless we continue to act for a different way. Last question, Bob.
You made the statement at one point that you know, the problem is usually one step above where we say it is.
Yeah.
Would it be equally justified to say that the organization is probably one step below where we think it is?
Absolutely. Very good point. That's exactly right. He is exactly right. If you think that you would have an affirmative action organization, you really actually probably have a token sacrificial organization. Yeah, absolutely. Good observation.
What's
that SR? Sorry, socially responsible. And that's my word for an organization in which the reason why we share mission, power, structure, and resources is not because of law, but really, I guess, because of gospel, because it's the loving thing to do, and it's a respectful thing to do, and somehow we create a better culture. And we don't need people around us reminding us, making us feel guilty. We just recognize it as the best way to live.
Do you have any specific ideas or suggestions from your experience on how to deal with the national media who give considerable attention to the 3 to 5% of the white races disproportionate to the 3 to 5% of the population?
That's
I mean, I like your idea of ignoring, but it's hard to ignore when it gets a pretty much more publicity. I don't know what to do to respond to that.
Yeah, you know, I really don't have a good response. Only that when I hear that, that's just more reinforcement for me that there's problems out there. If these numbers are growing, the active racist. You know, when I was living in Minnesota, I had heard that there was a new, or living in Iowa actually, that there was a new Klan organization being formed in southern Minnesota, and it was being formed by a 17-year-old. You know, what that inspires me to do is not to go look up that 17-year-old and try to change him, although, you know, there's a savior in me that would like to do that. I would probably, my temptation is to believe that that would be energy poured down the drain. But it is inspiration for me to say, okay, who are the passives in my community, and how can I get them to become active antis? So, I guess I don't have a great response, other than if we maybe need to educate the press about this and aim the presses. I think the press can have incredible transformative influence over our culture if they only knew exactly what to do. I think what they did to help us to understand the hunger situation in Ethiopia, you know, a few years back, really rallied the country to be responsive. But the press, unfortunately, like all organizations in the States, need to pay their bills, and they usually aim at what's sensational is going to make people turn in at the 5 o'clock news.
One of the explanations I heard a media guru of some sort give was that they thought by presenting this, if you let it out, you know, that truth will prevail, that goodness will come out, and so that they're giving this a lot of play, hopefully that people are going to see how bad this is. The problem is, I think it plays into the enormous number of prejudices that people have. And,
you bet.
I'm not as bad as that kind of stuff.
That's right. That's right.
And you're left with that kind of thing.
It's important stuff to, you know, to take a stand on, to let people know that there's a different way of seeing things. And I would really, like any substantive change in our lives, I really do believe if it begins at home, and then we take it to the work setting or the church setting. That's where it belongs. And for families to sit around and choose one thing you'll do as a family. If you don't have an immediate family around you, to try to find some support with equal intimacy and make a commitment to do something different.
One of the things that I agree with you on, as far as many times in state government or big companies, many of the goals that we have perhaps aren't as good as you make them sound. But I find it really discouraging that many of those organizations are further ahead than our churches. Our local congregation, we don't have any goals, objectives in this area whatsoever.
Great. One of the things that you can do, and Jan has helped me find some more resources over in the resource room if you'd like. Still trailing behind Black Americans, the nation scapegoating the black family. There are some other pieces. But the typical response is to believe, you know, that somehow it's the blacks or the Chicanos, those are the folks who need saving. And what we need to do is to examine, how does white privilege create this? And I usually, in other settings, with college students, I'll get a college student stand up and say, well, you know, Grace, are you saying that I need to give up my rights? And I say, no. I'm just asking you to give up your privileges.